You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers.
And Mena van Praag.
This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is Marianne Cavanagh. We've also got interviews with Tom Eales, who's an RAF pilot, or was an RAF pilot, for 44 years, and he's written about his experiences flying. And you spoke to Mandy Morton of this parish of Cambridge 105.
Yes, I was learning all about cats and detectives. It was very exciting.
So we'll be hearing from them later. But our studio guest is Marianne Cavanagh. Hello, Marianne.
Hello. I'm going to have to correct you.
Is it already? Have I got it wrong?
It's Cavanagh.
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 Cavanagh. I should have checked that. Never mind. Cavanagh. I'll say it as many times as I can. Now, we're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment and talk about the novels that you've written. But you've also got journalistic experience. That was when you first began writing, wasn't it, as a journalist?
Yes. I've worked in journalism for a long time, on staff originally, so commissioning and editing. And then I started writing features, which I've done freelance for a long time and still do.
So the difference between journalistic writing and novel writing, how did that work for you?
To be really honest, I think that's probably why I tend to write in quite short scenes, because I'm so used to writing quite short, pithy pieces where you have to get a lot of information over quite quickly. And I think that's probably why I write the way I do and why I tend to write from different character viewpoints so that I can use those short, contained scenes. But the other big difference, obviously, is that journalism pieces, they're quite short and novels are really long. And at the beginning, when you start writing a novel, you think, I can't do this. I'm used to writing 800 words, not 80,000. So that's quite a big change to discipline, to get used to dealing with a very big, long piece.
That's a different mindset altogether, isn't it? Because you're dealing with subplots and major plots and characters and thinking long term.
Yes, definitely. And you have to be, I know everybody has different ways of writing, but for me, I have to be sure that I have enough to say and that I'm really interested in these people enough to want to stay with them for that length of time, because it can take, you know, a year to write a book or more. So you have to be sure that you are really interested in that group of people.
Right, well, we'll be coming back to that group of people in just a moment. We're going to play your first choice of music now, though. That's Don't Get Me Wrong by The Pretenders. Why this one?
It's the title of the book, but please listen to the words, because they are very relevant to what's going on in the book.
So I was going to say, excellent choice of song. Love that. We're all dancing along. And when I had your book to read last week, every time I caught sight of the title, I started singing the song. Yeah. So I thought it was a really excellent choice of title. I wanted to know, was it a song that you always loved? Did that give you the inspiration for the story, or did it come? How did it come from?
I have always loved the song. I've always loved the song, partly because I think I really enjoy songs that have lyrics that tell a story, and I like the fact that they were quite magical lyrics in the song. It wasn't an inspiration as such, but when I started writing and I realised that the problem in the novel for everybody is they keep getting each other wrong, and then the two came together. And since I've written the novel and chosen the title, I keep realising how often people use that phrase all the time. It was one of those things that once you've heard it, you hear everybody saying it. And it's as if we're all very anxious that we misunderstand each other, and we're all trying to nudge the other person to understand our point of view, which I think is very much what's going on in this book.
What genre would you describe your books as? I mean, are they, you know, dare I say the word chick lit? I like chick lit. I have nothing against
it. I know. I personally find that quite difficult. I think really from a feminist point of view, I'm not really quite sure why it has to have such why it has to be cut off from all other books like that. I think, as Jojo Moyes said the other day, my books probably fall into what's called commercial women's fiction. But again, I'm not really quite sure why we have to divide books that way as well. I do think women writers have it harder, actually, because we get lumped together because of our sex, whereas I think books that are aimed at men tend to be divided into, say, thrillers or war books, or they tend to be much more about what the book's about rather than just aiming at the sex of the person reading.
And would you say that the thrust of both books is romance?
Yes, it's definitely love. I hope, though, also people will find, I do poke fun at people quite a lot, and I hope people will find them funny as well. I mean, the baddies, obviously, the bad people get get a hard time in my books. So I hope people will find them funny as well as the main thrust of it, yes, being about love.
Well, it's about love. With a story like that, you have to create engaging characters, don't you? We have to believe in the characters. We have to
yes.
want them to find happiness, find each other.
Yes, definitely.
How do you go about doing that?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I suppose I try to be sure that the characters are as believable as possible. I think once you have a character real to you, you put them together with the other characters and things tend to happen. I think if they are fully drawn in your mind as the kind of responses and reactions they would have, if you put them together with somebody else, they tend to lead the pace themselves, I think.
I suppose about, I'm sorry, Mena, I suppose it's about avoiding cliche as well, is it?
Yes, although I have to say that in this book, don't get me wrong, I do have quite a few romantic cliches because I am poking fun at them a little bit. So there will be stock characters and I hope I'm dismantling them slightly.
And do you love all your characters, even the baddies?
Yes, I do. I definitely admire the baddies. In this particular, oh, I don't want to give too much away. There is one character who starts off, and I think you like him. I like him.
I like him. But if we're talking about the same character.
No, we might not be. The particular character I'm talking about, when you first meet him, he seems very sympathetic. But as the book goes on, you realise actually he is just self-serving, and I've made him as... I had a lot of fun with him, especially when he gets caught up in business speak and company speak, which I find very amusing.
I think it can be more fun to write the baddies than the goodies. That's what I've discovered.
Yes, I think you're right. And people who are baddies are very good at it. You have to admire them. They're usually very skilled at manipulating other people and emerging from everything with a clean slate, as if, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. It was all the people around me who were failing. So, yes, I do admire them.
And what I liked about the characters in your book is they do have foibles. You know, there's strengths
yes.
and weaknesses, the flaws and weaknesses.
Yes.
You know, the hero isn't... I think we know he's the hero, but he's not, you know, dashing in on a white steed. He's flawed.
Yes, yes. And I think that's important. And I... Yes, very important, because none of us are perfect, are we? And people do have... even likeable characters have very strong flaws.
Was it harder to write the male characters?
It should be, shouldn't it? But actually, with my my lead character, I keep thinking I mustn't give too much away before people read
it.
You
can say his name.
Yes, Harry.
He,
one of the things he does, he's always loved boxing. And in fact, I've done a lot of martial arts in my life. And when he was boxing, I was thinking very much of all the people I know who do martial arts. So in a way, that was easier for me. I could understand what kind of person he was.
Oh, martial arts. We would get onto that later.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll shift gears slightly for the moment. You spoke to Mandy Morton. She's actually in the studio next to us
yes.
doing her mid-morning show as we're recording this.
I did. That was very fun. Mandy Morton began her professional life as a musician, as the lead singer of Spriggans. Her songwriting formed the basis of six albums during the 1970s and early 80s, when she toured extensively with her band. More recently, she's worked as a freelance arts journalist for national and local radio, specialising in making music and theatre documentary. She's the co-author of the non-fiction book In Good Company, and the number two feline detective agency was her first novel, and began a series of books inspired by her first cat, Hetty. Cat Among the Pumpkins is out today, and two more in the series follow next year. I began by asking Mandy why she's writing books where cats are the protagonists and no humans make an appearance.
No, not a person anywhere. It was the most important thing for me in writing these books, essentially, because, I mean, right from being a tiny little girl, I was read, first of all, Wind in the Willows, then progressed into being able to read it myself. And actually, it's a book I pick up, I guess, at least once a year. And even if I just sort of home in on a few passages here and there, it has been momentous in my life. When people are asked, which is the book? Wind in the Willows is the book. So I guess that this is a huge nod to that.
I also love the humour in the book. It reminded me a bit of P.G. Woodhouse.
That's a huge compliment, thank you. I'm afraid humour is something that you live with as a broadcaster. For years and years and years, I worked for the BBC, and of course there are, or were, very sort of rigid restraints there. You were an enabler as opposed to somebody that wanted to talk about themselves all day long. So as a presenter, you keep all this inside you. So I'm afraid that having sort of stepped down from the BBC, there's suddenly been a flood of humour that I wasn't able to use on air. I think that's it. Anyway, I was always the school joker, but I do have a wry and sometimes quite a dark sense of humour, I think, and it's lovely to have a channel to put it in.
There was something you said I loved. You give yourself a book to write as a treat in the winter, and I love that because so many writers say that writing's so hard and they've got to, you know, all blood, sweat and tears.
I think the joy of it is that I share my life with another author who also writes crime fiction novels. It is something that we do in the winter, because quite often in the summer it's when all the summer book festivals are on and you're out and about promoting whatever you've done, and we tend to do a lot of that work together. The moment that the autumn leaves start to fall, there's a melancholy that comes over me. It is an extraordinary thing. But as with cats, it's a time to get close to the fire and to pull a blanket around you. I need to feel like that when I write these books, because as with Wind in the Willows, there is that sort of feeling of security that descends, and you shut the curtains and you put the lights on and everything becomes warm and very, very cosy. You're not so outward going as you are in the summer.
What you say about that comfort, because when I read, I don't like crime that's too gory, but I love how the cats love their food. It felt like a big hug, you know, in a way. So you have the crime, but you have the comfort as well.
That's important, I think. And also, I mean, there are several spurs. Wind in the Willows, of course, was important. But the other thing that became very important to me was my long-term cat, Hetty, who, of course, is the main character in this book. She had something wrong with her and sadly passed away. And I felt robbed by the fact that I hadn't been able to see her through into very, very old age. So after we got over the grief of it, my partner and I started to adopt elderly cats. An elderly cat actually requires feeding, it requires keeping warm, and it requires love and comfort. That's what swells into these books. And I think anybody that's ever owned a cat will know that it's always the first by the fireplace, it loves its food. So all those traits are very important to keep the feline aspect of the book going, because obviously I've given them a lot of human traits as well.
And you were saying that you feel that you spend time with your cats that you've loved and lost while writing the book. That must be wonderful.
What is wonderful is being able to bring them back to life and to take tiny little bits of characterisation that you remember from those cats. I mean, Hetty was quite a fierce cat. Tilly, her sidekick in the book, was very mild, very beautiful and soft, and there was no side to her at all. But analytically, Tilly was perhaps slightly more intelligent than Hetty. But what I'm finding now is that all my friends that have cats, when sadly they lose them, they're keeping their fingers crossed that they may appear in the book. There are a couple in there at the moment. Great way of bringing them back to life.
I wrote down quite a lot of these wonderful names that these cats have. How did you come up with these names?
They just happen. I mean, they really do happen. My own cat, Hetty, was called Hetty Wainthrop after the investigator. And, of course, for these books, she couldn't be called Hetty Wainthrop, so I just came up with Bagshot. Tilly Jenkins or Matilda Jenkins. I came up with that one because it was a character in Cranford in the TV series, because that character was very mild and gentle and played by Dame Judi Dench, so you can't get better than that.
Did you set it at Halloween because it's a particular time of year that you enjoy? Or?
I just thought it was an absolutely delicious time to set it, and it is a nod to the original Halloween film, because the thread that runs through it is the legendary of murder of a family by a family member. So in this particular case, it's Milky Myers, who slaughters his whole family and then, of course, hangs out at Halloween in subsequent years to go and do the same thing again. Or does he?
So you're going to give us a reading.
I think the obvious place is the beginning, because it does set up the situation on how Hetty and Tilly share their days and why this number two feline detective agency exists. Because it is that time of year, we're addressing their special Halloween spooky night in. So here we go. The number two feline detective agency had closed early so that Hetty and Tilly could prepare for their spooky night in, although no one would have noticed, as their business premises was tucked away in the back room of Betty and Beryl Butter's High Street Pie and Pastry Shop. The room had become a sanctuary, first for Hetty after her shed with a bed was taken in a storm, and then for Tilly, an arthritic tabby whom Hetty had befriended and had fallen on hard times. The two had set up a comfortable home together, and thanks to Hetty's eye for an opportunity, they now ran a moderately successful detective agency, more by luck than judgment. The room came cheap, and the tenancy included a daily luncheon voucher to be spent in the butter's shop, as much coal as their small fire could consume, and a garden shed for the storage of Hetty's other lives. Of those, there had been many, including an almost triumphant music career which had dissolved in a haze of catnip more years ago than she cared to remember. In fact, Hetty's lives had become dominated by the words almost, nearly, and moderate, and the way she kept reinventing herself had only to be admired. Of the two cats, Tilly was definitely the homemaker, with an eye for comfort and an unshakable loyalty towards Hetty and her needs. In spite of her advanced years, she had become their friendship as Hetty's office junior, and had spent many months making tea, laying fires and dusting, while Hetty sat and thought about what their office might be for and how they might make ends meet. Even in the early days, Tilly had performed the daily ritual of transforming their cosy bedsitter into a place of work. Every morning, the cloth from the table was folded away in the drawer to reveal Hetty's desk, where the business of the day was conducted. Sometimes the business of the day consisted solely of getting the cloth out again at lunchtime for the midday meal, then returning it to the drawer status, ready to retrieve at dinner time. The idea of running a detective agency stemmed from Tilly's voracious appetite for murder mysteries, which she seemed to untangle long before the various authors had finished laying down their clues. Hetty had listened with growing interest to Tilly's critique of the incompetent detectives who bumbled their way through one investigation after another, and decided that they would venture into the seamy world of the gumshoe. Her latest scheme showed very promising signs of floundering before the newly printed business cards had been distributed, and had it not been for the high-profile Furcross case, which Hetty had solved by mistake, life would have been very different. The cats now busied themselves in preparation for their Halloween supper and scary film night. Tilly had spent the afternoon excavating two large pumpkins, while Hetty put the finishing touches to a talk she'd been invited to give to the local Methodist group on how to keep their valuables safe. "That's it. I've had enough for one day," she said, burying her notepad under a cushion. "What's for supper? I'm starving." Tilly's reply came from inside one of the pumpkins as she launched a final pawful of pale orange flesh over the side and into a bucket. "I've ordered Beryl's Halloween pie. It's topped with a witch's hat made of pastry and comes with an extra jug of gravy. Then we're having Betty's ghost and warlock tarts for the afters, and I've got a huge bag of Malkin and Sprinkles toffee popcorn to eat later with the video." Hetty purred with satisfaction at the prospect of such a feast and helped her friend out of the pumpkin. "I'll get rid of this gooey stuff and go round to the shop and fetch the pie." She dragged the bucket of pumpkin flesh out into the backyard, leaving Tilly to immerse herself in the sink. The daylight had disappeared, replaced now by a thickening icy fog, which descended on cue to make the town's Halloween night to remember. Kittens were dressed in ghoulish sheets and witches' cloaks, ready to be trotted out for tricks or treats, and as Hetty made her way round to the welcoming lights of the butter's shop, the air was fast filling with the smoke of sitting-room fires. The townsfolk settled in front of their hearths, comfortably oblivious to the fact that by the time daylight came, one of them would be dead, and Hetty and her official sidekick would be bucketed into a case that the town had thought solved many years before.
Ooh, that's Mandy Morton talking about her book Cat Among the Pumpkins. You're a cat person as well, Marianne Kavanagh, aren't you?
I am. I've got two cats, and one of them likes to entertain me when I'm writing by lying across my hands so I can't type a word.
That's a cat.
Very
for
helpful.
You. But it's interesting what Mandy was talking about, humour there, and using dark and wry humour. It's important in your books that you have humour as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think as well because, Don't Get Me Wrong, does have an incredibly sad passage in the middle, and I feel that in some ways if there wasn't humour as well it would be too dark, and I think in some ways humour does point up the sadness in life because of the contrast. Yes, it is important to me.
Yes, and there's light and shade in life, and
yes.
You need that in the book. Who's your reader? Who are you writing for when you write?
Oh, that's another really good question. I'm not sure.
Woman? I mean, can you narrow it down?
No, I don't think I could narrow it down, really. I do, my family always reads my first draft, and I do have friends who read the first draft too. And I take a lot of notice of what they say. My son, Ben, is actually a stand-up comic. He's just starting out as a stand-up comic, so it's important to me that he finds it funny. If there's a passage that doesn't work for him, then I'll rewrite it.
He's a useful resource to have at your fingertips.
Incredibly, yes.
Give me a joke. Inject some more humour.
Yes.
In here.
Well, we're going to be your listeners shortly because you're going to read a passage from the novel, but we're going to play your second choice of music now, which is For Once in My Life, Stevie Wonder. Why this
yes.
one?
Yes. This one is the title of my first book, and again, the lyrics are really important, and this song just makes me smile.
Needs me, someone I've needed so long. For once unafraid, I can go where life leads me. Somehow I know I'll be strong.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark, and our studio guest is Marianne Kavanagh. Got it right that time. That's double thinking.
I did.
It's going to become second nature soon. And you're going to read an extract from... Is this from Don't Get Me Wrong?
Yes, it is. It's from quite near the beginning of the book. It's 2006, and Kim and her friend Izzy have just graduated from university. For Kim, Eva, her elder sister, turned up to watch her graduate, but... As usual, Eva has brought Harry, and Kim can't stand Harry. Izzy has just offered to swap places with her so that she doesn't have to sit next to Harry. It wouldn't make any difference, thought Kim, as she followed Izzy through the crowded restaurant, even if he was at the other end of the table. It's that oozing self-confidence, that conviction he's right. It seeps into the air like fog. He laughs at everything I care about. He makes me feel small and insignificant, as if I'm scurrying about like a tiny black ant while he strides about like God. The very first time I met him, he blocked out the sun. What was I, 13? Lying in the back garden in tatty old shorts and a crop top, the grass long under my fingers, soaking up the first hot day for weeks. Christine next door said the TV weather map had turned completely orange. I could feel my skin burning, tiny prickles of heat. Always stay out of the sun, my mother used to say. So aging. My one act of teenage rebellion. Sunbathing. Kim, this is Harry. The world went dark. An eclipse. Eva said, we're going to buy ice cream. Do you want some? I couldn't speak. Half asleep, dazed by heat, I couldn't say a word. No ice cream. A deep voice. A posh boy voice. I looked up, but I couldn't see his face, just shadow like a cliff against the glaring white light. Are you always this talkative? Oh, leave her, Harry. She just wants to enjoy the sunshine. I put up my hand to shield my eyes, and now I could see his expression. Harry? Laughing at me, his whole face creased up, grinning from ear to ear, as if I was one huge joke. Harry, come on. Then he moved, and the sun blinded me. I sat up and the world was washed out like someone had bleached it. I kept staring as they sauntered back to the house. He was a head taller than Eva, but thin. Nothing but bones, as Christine would say. At the top of the concrete steps, he stopped. So that's your baby sister. I waited, very still. You know, she could look quite pretty if she smiled. The hurt, the rage. You'd think the years would make a difference, but they don't.
Oh, and the rest of the book sort of explores that love triangle. It's not too strong to say that, is it?
No, yes. I mean, Eva is very important to both of them in very different ways. And I think it's fair to say that Kim's first impression of Harry never really shifts. And unfortunately, he doesn't do a lot to change that first impression. So they do very much get each other wrong for many years. And as a result of that, events eventually spin out of control.
And did you know when you started writing it where the plot was going? Did you plot it out in advance so you knew how it would end?
Yes, I did, actually, very, very much so. I remember my son was studying in Munich, and I remember we sat at a restaurant in Munich, and I said to him, I want the novel to begin and end at the same place. And we worked it out together in the restaurant, how that could happen. So, yes, that overall structure was...
He's a great son to have.
Yes, absolutely.
We love him.
Just thinking the same thing. I hope my son's as useful when he grows up.
That's a reason to have children, isn't it? Talking about endings, when it's a certain genre, there is a certain expectation that there will be a particular kind of ending. Were you aware of that when you were writing?
I think it would be fair to say no. I think I followed the novel the way I felt it was naturally, and that the flow of the novel as I wrote it. It's published in the States as well, and I am getting the impression from some of the US readers that they feel the ending wasn't what they were expecting with a love story, if you like. I probably shouldn't say a lot more because I'd just love to know what people think in this country because it's just out in this country.
I have to say for myself, I love the ending.
Oh, good.
I really, really did. And I understand what you're saying. It reminded me, I think, in many American films, they change the endings, you know, to make them more, to make them bigger, to make them... They, in fact, change the ending to the Pride and Prejudice, Keira Knightley, to make it more mushy.
Yeah. I think... It may be a cultural thing, or it may just be the people I know who have put their thoughts online. But I think it seems that there is a general desire for a very definite, tied up, all the ends neatly tied up ending. And I perhaps haven't done that.
Which I appreciate.
But what do you do with that feedback, in a way? Is that going to influence what you write next? Because you can't change this ending, and you don't want to, by the sound of it.
No. It's very difficult, actually, when you hear feedback, because the last thing you want to do is disappoint people. You know, I want people to enjoy what I write. I want them to be happy. It's just slightly puzzling sometimes when what you've intended... when you're writing doesn't, well, because a book is more than just the person who writes it. A book is a relationship between the writer and the reader, and something, if you're lucky, something magic happens between the two. So yes, I'm unhappy if people feel the ending wasn't what they expected, but probably no, if I went back, I wouldn't change it, I don't think.
And we are in an age where you do have more contact with readers.
Definitely.
People might have been disappointed with Jane Austen's endings, but nobody...
they didn't say so.
they couldn't say so in their thousands. So, you do have a relationship because you're on Twitter, so you're on social media, suddenly you do have sometimes quite one-to-one relationships with readers.
Definitely, and I really love it when people take the trouble to write and say that they love the book, and I'm particularly pleased when people have said they were moved by it, because, yes, that makes me happy. That's good.
And speaking of Jane Austen, it's been called a Pride and Prejudice for the modern era. How lovely was that to hear as a description?
It is lovely. I think it's pretty dangerous, though, because people think that... I hope no one's expecting the brilliance of Jane Austen in this book. It is, because it's about two people who can't see eye to eye, very much as Pride and Prejudice was, and who, because they don't talk to each other, end up with awful situations which make them both very unhappy. So I think the similarity is there. But no, I love Jane Austen. I'm not Jane Austen.
And that wasn't a template? It wasn't like a modern reworking of...
No, definitely not. No, it was the feeling, really, just... and I suppose partly as well, because in the book, Harry is a financial analyst and he is obscenely wealthy. So I suppose you could imagine Mr. Darcy, who also was, you know, in terms of Jane Austen's time, incredibly wealthy. But actually, Kim, my heroine, is a lot poorer than Lizzie Bennet. I mean, Kim hasn't got, yes, much money at all. So, yes. But the difference is, I suppose, between wealth and lack of wealth.
Right, thank you for that. We'll come back to talking about the novel and just how it got onto the printed page, how you made that shift from journalism to novel writing. But we're going to shift gear, literally, actually, with a joystick. Tom Eales served in the RAF for 44 years, from 1961 to 2005. His book, A Passion for Flying, is the story of his years as a pilot. I met him at his home in Suffolk. We're sitting in your study. Your book is called A Passion for Flying, and I'm looking around at the pictures on the wall, and I can see pictures of planes and models of planes. Clearly, you still have a passion for flying.
That's correct. And in fact, I was flying only last Friday in a chipmunk.
Do you think something like that's in your blood? Because you came from an Air Force family, didn't you?
Yes, I think so. I mean, my earliest memories are of being brought up on an RAF fighter station in the 1940s, which was very exciting for a seven-year-old. My father was a pilot in the Air Force before the wars and throughout the war, and indeed after the war, so flying really was in my family. All I ever wanted to be was a pilot.
And can you remember that first flight you took?
The first proper flight, other than as a passenger, was in about 1953-54, when my uncle, who ran an auxiliary Air Force Meteor fighter squadron at Biggin Hill, was detailed off to take me out from school for the day. So I was taken to RAF Biggin Hill. I was sat into a deck chair, given a pile of wagon wheel biscuits and told to keep quiet, eat the biscuits and not make a fuss. But I'm sad to say I did make a fuss. I made such a fuss that I was determined to get up in one of the aeroplanes. And eventually they relented and strapped me into the back of a Meteor T-7, which was the two-seat version of the fighter aircraft. And off we went in this aeroplane. I'm still wearing my school shorts and my blazer, strapped into a parachute. And off we went. We went and beat up my school, which was very satisfying, and did some aerobatics and everything. And
when you say beat up your school, what do you mean by that?
Flew low over it.
Ah, is that
speed.
What that means?
Yes. The wagon wheel stayed inside me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And from that moment onwards, there was absolutely nothing else I ever wanted to do for a career.
And it's called A Passion for Flying. 50 years in the cockpit, and I think, yes, you break it down into hours as well,
yes,
don't you?
I finally achieved 8,500 flying hours in the Royal Air Force. Not a huge sum by comparison to your average airline pilot, who's up in the 15 to 20,000 hours. But all those 8,500 hours were earned in small aeroplanes, which generally didn't fly for more than about an hour to 2 hours at a time. So it was a good rate of flying, let's put it that way.
So when you're sitting here now and you see these jets go zooming past, are you itching? Do you think, oh, I would love to have flown one of those?
Yes, when a fast jet comes over the house, which isn't very common nowadays, of course, I usually rush out to have a look and see what it is. It would be nice. You have to recognise that flying, particularly military fast jets, is a young man's sport, really. I'd be too old and slow to cope. But
that why? You need the reactions, do you?
You need quick reactions, yes. They look for different qualities in today's jet pilots as compared to when I went through my flying training in the 1960s. In those days, the aeroplanes were challenging to fly. So you needed people who had good hand-to-eye coordination skills, who were good games players, if you like, who could cope with rapidly changing situations. The aeroplanes went wrong on a regular basis. Today, the aeroplanes are far, far more reliable. they're much, much easier to fly because all the difficult handling characteristics which those jets of the 1960s had have been engineered out with computerization. So the aeroplanes are very easy to fly. The challenge is making all the systems that the aeroplane is equipped with now work to your best advantage. So we really look for the Xbox generation now, people who are good at computer games, rather than the man who's got good hand-to-eye coordination skills, because the aeroplanes, by and large, look after themselves now.
Well, let's talk about the book, because you've flown an awful lot of planes, haven't you?
Yes.
How many different kinds of planes do you think you've flown?
Oh, I'd have to get my logbook out and actually count. I mean, it's well over 50. I was just extremely lucky in that once I went through flying training, I was posted, first of all, to a Canberra light bomber squadron in Germany, which was very interesting, especially being based in Germany in the early 1960s. Whilst I was there, I got the opportunity to go on what was called loan service with the Royal Navy. This seemed to be a good idea, as I was still a bachelor and had no real ties to terra firma. So I went off to fly with the Royal Navy, flying the Buccaneer from aircraft carriers, which was a completely different business altogether. Absolutely fascinating, very exciting. It also enabled me to go out to the Far East and see places which I probably wouldn't have normally seen. When I came back from my time with the Navy, I went to the Central Flying School and became a flying instructor. And, of course, that opened up another enormous area of flying activity, teaching people to fly. I've been very lucky in that I've taught people to fly at every level, from the day when they arrive, never having seen an aeroplane before in their lives, right through to the end when you take someone who is really pretty competent as a pilot and you're just finishing him off as a frontline operational pilot. I've served in all the categories of that flying as an instructor, which was very satisfying.
And they're all listed in the book. Is that why you wrote the book, as a sort of record for yourself as much as anything?
No, not really. I have in my possession this diary, which my grandfather wrote in 1878 when he was only 20 years old, which is the sort of Victorian equivalent of a gap year experience. It's handwritten and it's been preserved in its entirety. And it's absolutely fascinating. It talks about his experiences on a voyage from Cardiff to Odessa in a ship which was sail-driven and steam-driven. And it's quite fascinating window on what it was like to be a 20-year-old in the late Victorian era. I thought that it would be rather good to leave something equivalent for future generations in my family to read, if only to say how extraordinary what they got up to in the 1960s and 70s in the air. And so that's how I started to write. Initially, I really had no intention of having it published, but a great friend of mine, colleague from the Air Force, who's written a number of books on aviation matters, happened to see it when staying here and urged me to get it published, which is why it is now available.
And how did you go about researching the things you'd done? Do you just have a memory where you could remember something? Is it in your log and your files, your personnel files somewhere?
I think I have a pretty good memory. One's flying logbooks are essential, really, because you can then put incidents into the right time frame and it brings back lots of memories. All you have to do is look at a single sortie written down in the logbook and it brings back, oh yes, I remember what happened then. So logbooks, of which I've got all my own logbooks still, are a key ingredient. Photograph albums, they're very useful as well. So a combination of all that and memory really enable me to write what I have done.
And do you have one outstanding memory of all that time flying?
Well, good or bad?
Both.
Too many good ones, really, because flying never disappointed, really, whether it was rushing around high speed in a fast jet aeroplane or flying in a lowly little piston engine trainer around 100 miles an hour and watching cars on the M11 overtake you. It was all good and enjoyable and fascinating. It's difficult to actually single out one good time.
And you've never flown in combat?
Not really. During my time on the Canberra squadron in Germany, we were deployed out to the Far East, to Malaya, during the confrontation with Indonesia, where we reinforced the squadrons out there. We lived for 4 months under canvas on a remote aerodrome on the east coast of Malaya, and it was potentially the closest we could have gone to combat. But confrontation had virtually fizzled out by that time. Most of the fighting was being carried out in the jungles on the Andaborneo with really very little fast jet aviation activity involved with it. It was mainly helicopters, and so we didn't actually drop a bomb or fire a bullet in anger. And of course, after that, it was the Cold War. We practiced and we practiced and we practiced, but we never actually went to war. During the Falklands, I was on a ground appointment at the headquarters of RAF Strike Command, so I had to watch from the wings, as it were. But again, the aeroplanes that I was involved with, the Buccaneer, were not involved in the Falklands War.
Would you have liked to have been involved in combat?
It's a difficult question, that. I think that if you join the Air Force as a military pilot, of course you want to see what happens when you are pushed into that situation. How you react is very difficult to tell. Here we are celebrating 75 years of the Battle of Britain this autumn. Many young men were pitchforked into battle, really not knowing what was going to happen to them or how they would react. You can only discover when you actually do it.
That's Tom Eales there talking about his book A Passion for Flying. Our studio guest is Marianne Kavanagh. Marianne, I said just before Tom's interview, we're going to find out how you made that shift from journalism to novel writing. Did you know an agent, or did you send your manuscript to an agent? How did it come about?
No, I didn't. I did what I'm sure a lot of people do, which is to spend a lot of time online reading about how you find an agent. And I did learn something very important that I would like to pass on as a tip to anyone else who's thinking of writing a novel. Don't just approach agents individually, because they do spend quite a long time getting back to you. So it's a good idea to approach a number of them, say that you've done it, and then you've got a better chance of things moving along a little more swiftly. Because you'll be right for some, you know, you'll be totally wrong for one agent and absolutely right for another. And even with all your best research, you might be sending the novel to someone who's just never going to be interested.
Because of your background in writing, presumably there was a certain expectation that you could write and that you could meet deadlines, etc.
I hope so. Yes, I hope so. My agent, at the moment, she's always very amused whenever she wants any revisions done. And I say to her, give me a deadline. And she says, what do you mean, give you a deadline? I said, I can't work without a deadline. Give me a deadline. So she does understand that my background is relevant to what I'm doing now.
And how much input does she have on what you're writing?
She's a very good reader. So she will read when I think I've got it in the best state I possibly can. Then she reads it, and she's very clear. She says, you know, this doesn't work for me. Think about whether you're sure you want to leave that in. Sometimes she'll actually suggest a cut, which always works. You know, she's very clear-sighted.
And are you ever tempted to revisit any of the characters that you set up? Will there be any sequels or anything?
Funnily enough, at the end of For Once in My Life, everybody said, oh, I want to know what happens next. I don't think so. I think, in a way, I like the idea that you just glimpse into people's lives for a stretch of time. And then maybe your own imagination takes over as a reader and you decide what happened to them next.
I think it's always nice to leave us wanting more.
Yes, presumably that's it's a bit like Jane Austen, actually, isn't it? Yes, she always left people wanting more a little bit. And is this your genre now? Do you see yourself writing maybe it's crime or science fiction, or
I definitely want to carry on writing fiction. I think it's completely addictive. I imagine it's a bit like being a taxi driver, that part of your brain then focuses on that, and that's all you want to do. In fact, my third novel is with my agent now, and it's very, very different. So I hope people won't be cross. But no, I have moved away from this particular kind of love story. So we'll just have to see.
Oh, I'm intrigued by that.
Yes, why have you moved away?
Can you tell us anything?
It was a story that's been burning a hole in my head for a long, long time, and I think I finally found a way of writing it that worked for me. So I'm hoping very much that people who've enjoyed the first two books will come with me for the next one.
And what's your process when you write? Do you have a routine?
I think my process is complete obsession. I don't know if you'd agree with that. I mean, basically, when a book is sort of burning in your mind, and I can only really put it that way, I'm very hard to live with because I'm not really thinking of anything else. And so I tend to wake up incredibly early in the morning, almost with a bit of the book in my head that I just want to go downstairs and start writing. I think at that first draft stage when you're getting it out, I don't think you could live like that forever because, A, it's horrible for your family, but also it's quite tiring. And when you've actually finished it and you finish the first draft, you think, oh, God, that was an enormous thing to do. And then you take a little break before you come back to edit it. So, yes, it's very obsessive when I'm actually writing it. It's, you know, long days, early in the morning till late afternoon.
So that's the third book with the agent.
Yes.
Is there another one in...
I should say yes, shouldn't I? But no, not
well,
at the moment.
I don't know how far you have to think ahead, do you?
Well, ideally, when you've finished writing one book and the book is with your agent, you should be starting to plan the next because they take a while, I think. But no, I'm going to be going on lots of long walks, I think. And I've got, yes, you're right. I have got some very, very, very vague ideas, but nothing I could say was a properly, fully fledged idea yet.
But you need that rest time in between.
Oh,
I mean,
you.
Not only do you need it, but that's where the inspiration comes, I find, you know, on
yes.
the long walks. And then suddenly your mind can be thinking, oh, my God, I can't come up with another idea. Am I ever going to come up with another idea? Well, do I have another book in me? And then
yeah.
suddenly something will come to you.
Yes. And I don't know if you find the same. It is often very much when you're doing something which is nothing to do with writing. So I always think something very involved, like you know, clearing out a cupboard or cleaning the oven or something. And then you suddenly think, oh, and you realise that your mind is working on it, even if you're not conscious of it.
There's a great quote from Agatha Christie that says, the best time to plan a book is when you're doing the dishes.
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly the same kind of thing, yes.
I suppose you're switching that bit of your brain off, aren't you? And it's churning nevertheless, and then it kind of pops up.
I think it's definitely true that the mind, human minds, work in very different ways than we're always conscious of. And sometimes you do need to not be thinking consciously in order for, I think, I'm sure people would say that in all walks of, I'm sure great mathematicians have their brilliant ideas when they're actually doing something completely different.
I do wonder if you're writing in a genre like romance, whether it's harder to switch off, because romance is everywhere, isn't it? Almost every film you go to see, there is a romantic storyline. When you meet friends, you know, they're talking about what's happening with their love life or somebody else's
yes.
love life. And whether you can plug into that and borrow bits of it without people realising.
I think it's true, and I'm sure all novelists say this, that there's nothing better than being on a bus. I mean, it's so lovely. You sit there apparently reading your paper or looking at your phone and your ears are really tuned to everything that's going on around you, because that's when you hear the little bits of speech and the little tiny half sentences that make you think, oh, I wonder what the story behind that is.
I was once on the way back from King's Cross and a girl was breaking up with her boyfriend on her mobile phone
whole
way. And I was entranced. You know, I was by the whole thing, and I find it really funny that people think when they're speaking on their mobile phones that
yeah.
they're having a private conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, that's excellent. Oh, that yeah, that would occupy you for the entire journey, wouldn't it?
It was. It was a soap opera. I loved it.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show, sadly, now, Marianne. But before you go, is there one book, I just wondered, that you, as a writer, keep going back to, either that's a writing advice book, I don't know whether you've read any of those, or that's just a book that you just can't stay away from? You know, we all have one.
It's one I discovered relatively recently, and I can't stop rereading it. It's Mrs. Bridge by Evan S. Connell. Recommend it. The way it's written is just, I think it's superb. Very, very, very simple. Says an awful lot with a very few words.
That's Mrs. Bridge by Evan.
He wrote a companion novel sometime later called Mr. Bridge. So there you go. I really, really recommend it.
What's Mr. Bridge like? Is he as good as his wife? Have you read that one?
Yes. Oh, yes, I have read. Mrs. Bridge is the first one. It's about a marriage and a family, and Mr. Bridge sees it from his point of view. It is just as interesting. You would think, actually, revisiting this family through a different character would be quite hard, but he makes it incredibly easy.
Wasn't it made into a film with Paul Newman?
It was, indeed.
Yes, I thought so.
Oh, well done.
Big fan.
Yeah, top points. I can see why that appeals to you as well, those different perspectives, because that pops up in your novels.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for coming to
see us.
Thank you.
It's been lovely to meet you both. Thank you.
Our next show, our studio guest is crime writer Susan Grossi. She writes crimes. She writes books, about financial crime, featuring financial corruption at the heart. We've also got interviews with writer and illustrator Elise Dolan, and you'll be talking
to Nicola Upson,
who's also a crime writer. So it'd be
Cambridge crime.
There's lots of crime in Cambridge.
Apparently there is.
It is. It's a crimey city, a crimey writey city. If you want to listen to any of the old bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and all the programmes are there since we first started many, many years ago. So do feel free to download them. We're going to play out now with your last choice of music, Marion. This is a lovely, lovely song. It's When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge. Why have you chosen this?
Just because I love it, and I've always loved it.